We have visitors with us. We hope that you feel at home in our midst and that you'll want to come back and worship the Lord with us again as you have the opportunity to do that. If you were here last Sunday, I hope you remember that I started talking with you about establishing fellowship in the local church. And I want to quickly review the main points that we made in that particular sermon, and then we'll conclude our study this morning by looking at some objections that people sometimes raise to the things that I taught you last Sunday morning. Last week, I reminded you that fellowship in the universal church is something that happens automatically. That's something that Jesus takes care of. When one becomes a Christian, Jesus makes him a member of his body, cements him as a living stone in the spiritual house, inaugurates him as a citizen in the kingdom, adopts him as a child in the family of God. But fellowship in the local church is not automatic. By the way, when we talk about fellowship, we're talking about joint participation in spiritual things. When we talk about the local church, we're talking about a group of Christians who have banded together to work and worship together to do the things that Christ wants them to do as a body of believers. Fellowship in the local church is not something that is automatically. It does not necessarily exist when one becomes a Christian. I asked you last week what local church was the Ethiopian eunuch a member of when he came up out of the waters of baptism. He and the evangelist Philip were on the road between Jerusalem and Gaza. There was no local church around, as far as we know, and the eunuch was headed home to Ethiopia. Were there churches in Ethiopia? Perhaps, but we don't really know. When Saul of Tarsus went off into Arabia after his conversion, what local church was he a member of? Well, we really don't know. Fellowship in a local church is established by agreement between an individual Christian and a local congregation. And I stressed three important points about all of this last week. God wants His people to be in fellowship with other Christians in a local church, but it is certainly the case that fellowship in a local church may not always be possible. It's conceivable that a Christian might find himself in an area or in circumstances where there are no other Christians around. Can he serve God in a situation like that? Of course he can. Is he a member of the universal church? Of course, he is. But it may not be possible for him to be a member of a local congregation. And we stressed last week that care must be exercised on the part of the individual Christian and the local church when it comes to establishing fellowship. This care must be exercised because fellowship between Christians is based upon our mutual fellowship. Oh dear. Hang on, folks. I was trying to get my clicker to work. Fellowship between Christians is based upon our mutual fellowship with one another. And I reminded you last week that things are not always as they appear to be. Christians aren't always faithful to Christ. And churches aren't always faithful to God. Hey, my clicker is working. Care must be exercised in establishing fellowship because the New Testament teaches that neither individual Christians nor local churches can have fellowship with sin. And then we're just commanded to be cautious. And so last week, I stressed that fellowship must not be extended on a superficial basis. Some folks become a member of a church simply because the building is close to where they live. Well, let me tell you, folks, we need a better reason than that for establishing fellowship in a church. And then we stressed last week that fellowship must be extended on a scriptural basis. And that means that an individual Christian should seek to join a local church that's striving to be what Christ wants it to be in its work, its worship, and its organization. I'm not saying that you've got to find a perfect church, because if you did and you became a member of it, you'd mess it up because you're not perfect. We're not going to find a perfect church, but we need to find a local church that's trying to be what Christ wants it to be. And a local church should extend fellowship to those who are walking in the light, as best as we can determine. Now, that was a quick review of what we were talking about last week. And we went into a lot more details. And if you weren't able to be here to hear that sermon and you want to consider those details, then I would urge you to go to the website and listen to that sermon as it has been recorded. But what I want to do this morning is respond to some objections that some people make to what I taught you last week. And that's where we'll spend our time this morning. And the first objection that often is raised is based upon a statement that Jesus made in the Sermon on the Mount when Jesus said, "Judge not that you be not judged." Now, Brother Roger Shouse in our gospel meeting recently had a few things to say about this particular passage, and so I don't want to belabor the point, but just to remind you that Jesus' statement is not a condemnation of all forms of judgment. And I know that because in John chapter 7, Jesus, while condemning a certain kind of judgment, commanded a different kind of judgment. He said, John 7:24, "Do not judge according to appearance," that's the wrong kind of judgment, "but judge with righteous judgment." That's the right kind of judgment. You see that he's talking about two different kinds of judgment there. He condemns one, he commends another. It's interesting to me that it is quite common when I talk to people about their soul and I point out some areas where they need to make changes, that they will bring up this statement of Jesus. They will say, "Well, but Jesus says, judge not that you be not judged." Do you notice that they're doing the very thing that they say I shouldn't do? You notice they're judging me for judging them? The argument that they're making really is self-defeating. They're doing the very thing that they say I shouldn't do. The fact of the matter is, if you look at the context in which this statement is made, that context indicates that there are times when we must make judgment about other people. Look at verse 6 of Matthew chapter 7. Jesus said, "Do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn and tear you in pieces." Now let me ask you a question. How can I follow Jesus' instructions in that verse if I don't make some kind of a determination about who the dogs and the swine are? You see my point? If I'm not to give that which is holy to the dogs, if I'm not to cast my pearls before swine, I've got to make some judgment about who the dogs and the swine are. And that involves a judgment on my part. Look down to verse 15. Jesus said, "Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves." How can I follow the Lord's instructions in that verse if I don't make a judgment about who the true prophet is and who the false prophet is? The Bible condemns a certain kind of judgment, and it commands a different kind of judgment. Well, what kind of judgment is Jesus condemning here in Matthew chapter 7? Well, let's begin reading in verse 1. "Judge not that you be not judged, for with what judgment you judge, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. And why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, 'Let me remove the speck from your eye,' and look, a plank is in your own eye? Hypocrite, first remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye." The kind of judgment that Jesus is forbidding here is a hypocritical kind of judgment that wants to clean up your neighbor's backyard and you haven't cleaned up your own yard first. And please notice that Jesus does not criticize this fellow for wanting to help his neighbor get the speck out of his eye. What he criticizes is he's got this log sticking out of his own eye. He says, "Get the log out of your eye first." By the way, I think when you stop and think about it, this is a rather humorous picture that the Lord paints here. I think the Lord had a sense of humor. So the kind of judgment that Jesus is forbidding here is a hypocritical judgment that sees the faults in other people and ignores the faults that we have in our own life. And so it is just not a valid objection to argue that the Christian should never make any kind of judgment about any person at any time. We have to do that sometimes. We need to be sure that it's the right kind of judgment, that it's righteous judgment, not judgment by appearance, we need to be sure that we're taking a long look at the man in the mirror before we point the accusing finger at the other fellow. But it is just a fact that there are times when Christ expects his people to make judgments about others. Well, another objection that some have raised is that, well, we should accept people at their word until their word proves to be unreliable. Well, that sounds pretty good on the surface, I'll admit. But let's think about this a little bit more closely. Let me remind you that evidently the Apostle Paul did not expect churches to accept strangers into their fellowship without words of commendation. Do you remember what we said about that last week? That there was a pattern of commendation in first century churches. For example, in Romans chapter 16, Paul offered the brethren in Rome words of commendation for the sister in Christ named Phoebe who was going to be visiting those churches. And there's many other examples like that. If a stranger, and I emphasize the word stranger, if a stranger were to come to this church and ask to become a member, should he be accepted if all he says is, well, I'd like to be a member of this church? If that's all he says and that's all we know, should we accept him as a member into our local fellowship? Well, now, if you say no, then you've really surrendered this objection. Because what you're saying is that at least in this instance, under that circumstance, we shouldn't just accept someone merely on the basis of his expressed desire. If you say no to that question, you've really conceded that a local church does have a right to ask at least some questions. Well, what if someone were to come and ask to be a member of this church and all he says is, well, I'm a Christian and I'd like to be a member of this church? Well, would denominationalists say something like that, perhaps? I know of a non-Christian who asked to be a member of a local church in Bowling Green, Kentucky, and I was preaching in that area at that time, and the local preacher knew that this young lady wasn't really a Christian. She thought she was, but she had not been scripturally baptized. And the preacher handled that in a very tactful way. I don't really know or remember the details about how all that worked out. But you see, this kind of thing can happen. I understand, I kind of heard through the grapevine, and I know you can't always believe everything you hear through the grapevine, but I heard that there was another church in Bowling Green who had accepted a fella into their fellowship, and sometime later, I think maybe it was years later, they find out this fella's not really a Christian. They thought he was, but nobody asked any questions. You see the problem? Suppose someone were to come and say, well, I want to be a member of this church, and all he says is, well, I've been baptized, and I want to be a member. Well, might someone who believes that baptism can be administered by sprinkling or pouring say something like that? Bible teaches that baptism is immersion. But there are churches out there who tell us that the mode of baptism isn't really important. You can be baptized by sprinkling or pouring or immersion. And there are folks who will tell you, well, I've been baptized, but they had some water sprinkled on them or water was poured on their head. Is that really baptism? Well, what if somebody were to come and ask to be a member of this church and he says, I've been immersed? If that's all he says, should we just accept that and ask no other questions? Well, is immersion in water, is that the only thing that makes baptism scriptural? What if a bunch of teenagers went down to the local swimming hole and they're horsing around like teenage boys do, and one fella dunks another fella under the water? Is that immersion? Some of you are nodding your heads. Some of you are just sitting there. I don't see anybody asleep. That's good. We're not going to say that's baptism, are we? Even though it's immersion. Why not? Well, it wasn't intended to be baptism, and it wasn't immersion for the remission of sins. They were just horsing around. And folks, there are churches out there who practice immersion, but they don't immerse people for the remission of sins. They tell you you're saved before baptism and without baptism. So should we accept someone into our fellowship if he just comes to us and, well, I've been immersed? Well, what if a fellow comes to us and he says, well, I'm a member of You Name It Church of Christ, and I've moved into the area, and I want to be a member of this church. Well, what if the disorderly brother in Thessalonica went to Berea and said something like that? Should the church in Berea have accepted a fellow like that? He's been disciplined, withdrawn from by one church. He runs over here to this other church, says, I want to be a member here. Now, sometimes churches can get it wrong. They can discipline people when they shouldn't. I know that's possible. But if they get it right, if they discipline someone who really should be disciplined, and they do that in the right way, should another church across town just welcome this fella in? What do you think about that? What if the immoral brother in the church at Corinth who had taken his father's wife, what if he went to Athens and said, well, I'm a member of the church, and I want to be a member here? Well, hopefully, you can see the point that I'm trying to make. If you can ask a stranger anything about his conversion, about his relationship with the Lord, then what you ask and how much you ask is a matter of judgment. And I know what you want to know. You want to know, well, what should we ask and how much should we ask and when have we asked enough? And all I can say about that is that's a matter of judgment. And I would say you need to stop when you have made reasonable inquiry and investigation. I don't think we have to hire a private detective. I don't think we have to put the fellows on a rack and interrogate him. Nothing like that. But remember, our fellowship with one another is based upon our mutual fellowship with God. And so we shouldn't extend fellowship to folks if they're not in fellowship with God. Well, somebody might say, well, now, if we do this, we're just like the Baptists who vote people into the church. Well, I don't know an awful lot about the practice of the Baptist church, but I would say to you, even if this is exactly like what they do, would that mean that it's wrong? Baptists believe in the verbal inspiration of the Scriptures. They believe in three distinct persons in the Godhead. They believe in the virgin birth of Christ and the deity of Jesus. And they believe in His bodily resurrection. They teach that baptism is immersion. Now, they don't baptize for the right reason, if I understand the Scriptures properly. So when I say we need to ask some questions before extending fellowship in the local church, if that's just exactly like what some other religious group might do, that doesn't in and of itself necessarily mean that it's wrong. Really, when we ask questions, all that we're doing is testing a man's claims by comparing his life with the teaching of the New Testament. What's wrong with that? Why shouldn't we do that? Well, somebody says, but now wait a minute, Kevin. There's no example in the New Testament where a church refused to extend fellowship to somebody. Well, let me remind you, and we talked about this last week, that the church in Jerusalem did not immediately accept Saul of Tarsus into their fellowship. Because at first, they didn't believe that he was a disciple. Now, they were wrong about that. And Barnabas spoke up and vouched for Paul, and when Barnabas did that, then the church in Jerusalem accepted Saul. But they didn't immediately and automatically accept him just because he wanted to join their fellowship. But then I would say to you, even if there were no examples in the New Testament of a church refusing to accept someone into its fellowship, that doesn't mean there's no authority for asking questions and making reasonable inquiry. Because you see, Bible authority is established in various ways, by means of express statements and direct commands and implications in the Scriptures. Furthermore, there's no example of a church meeting in a meeting house. You can't read of the first century church preaching the gospel over radio and television. Of course, they didn't have radio and television in them their days. Are we going to argue that we shouldn't do that kind of thing today if we can afford that because it wasn't done in the first century? We're not going to argue that. Well, somebody asks, who are we to refuse fellowship to someone who is in fellowship with God? Well, I would be the first to say we don't have the right to refuse fellowship to someone who is in fellowship with God. And we have no intention of doing that. But let me ask another question. Who are we to extend fellowship to someone who is not in fellowship with God? You see, that sword cuts both ways. I want to be in fellowship with every person who is in fellowship with God, who wants to be a part of this local group. And I think you want that too. But we don't have the right to extend fellowship to somebody who's really not in fellowship with God. Actually, this question assumes the very thing that needs to be proven. And that is that someone who claims to be in fellowship with God actually is in fellowship with God. Well, somebody says, well, what right do we have to question somebody else's word? Brethren, we have not only the right, but the responsibility. Because, as I've already said, Jesus tells us that things aren't always as they appear to be. He talks about those false prophets who are ravenous wolves in sheep's clothing. They look like sheep. Maybe they smell like sheep, but they're not sheep. They're wolves. And as we noted last week, we've been commanded to prove all things and to test the spirits and to watch and be careful. Well, somebody says, well, the practice that you're talking about could lead to terrible abuse. And that's true. It could be abused. But isn't it the case that every lawful thing can be abused? Preaching from the pulpit can be abused if the preacher makes it a whipping post for everybody. Bible classes can be abused. The Lord's Supper can be abused. Isn't that what happened at Corinth? Didn't the Corinthians abuse the practice of the Lord's Supper in the first century? So are we to abandon these practices that are lawful and right simply because they might be abused? We don't want to go there, do we? What I'm saying, brethren, is that we mustn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Well, somebody asked, Why would we want to talk with someone who has been scripturally baptized about local church membership? Well, I would suggest to you that being a member of a local church is like being on a team. It involves working together and worshiping together. If somebody wants to be on a team, doesn't he need to abide by the team rules? Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not talking about any man-made rules that aren't authorized by the Lord. Our team rules are found in this book right here. But what if somebody doesn't want to abide by the team rules? What if somebody doesn't want to do what Jesus says Christians should do if they're going to be a member of a local church? In years gone by, I've baptized folks, and then I couldn't get them to darken the door of the church building. Is that a problem? When one wants to become a member of a local church, he needs to know what God expects of him in that relationship. Just as if two people want to get married, they need to know what God expects of them in that relationship. I once talked to a fella, and this has been years ago. He wanted to become a Christian, but he didn't want to go to church. Well, should I have baptized him? If he had wanted to be just a member in name only, should that have been accepted? I took him to Acts chapter 2. Where Luke says of those very first converts, and they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship, in the breaking of bread and in prayers. That's what the first converts did. You see, in their lives, baptism wasn't the end, it was the beginning. And they became a part of that local church in Jerusalem, and they worked and they worshiped together. And I told this fellow that what he was wanting to do isn't the way things work in the Lord's kingdom. Brethren, I believe that all of the passages and the principles that we've talked about last week and some again today, explicitly or implicitly, indicate that a local church has not only the right but the responsibility as far as its membership is concerned. Again, I don't believe that a local church should engage in some kind of an inquisition complete with rack and thumb screws. That's not what I'm talking about at all. But I believe it has the right and the responsibility to make reasonable inquiry, to try as best we can to determine if someone who wants to be a part of our fellowship is in fellowship with God. And again, what constitutes reasonable inquiry is a matter of judgment. Our fellowship with one another is based upon our mutual fellowship with God. Well, that's what I wanted to share with you. And I appreciate your very kind and careful attention. I hope this study will be helpful. After the lesson last week, one of the members of this church told me, "Well, you made some points that I'd really never thought about before." And another member told me, "Well, Kevin, I thought about some of those things, but I'd never really kind of put them all together." I hope that is an indication that our study was helpful, at least to those two Christians. I hope that it's been helpful for all of us. Well, we're going to stand and sing our invitation hymn. If your life's not right with the Lord, you need to get right with Him. And if you know what you need to do, we would urge you to do that, and we would be honored to help you in any way that we can. You can come right now as we stand and we sing.